Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Censored. I'm Aoife Vritnoch, historian and obsessive reader. Happy New Year, everyone. Here's to another year of frolicking through the filth. If you'd like to support the show, you can find links to Patreon and my merch store in the show notes. Patreon people get the show early, with extra research notes and full-length interviews. Of course, you can always leave me a review in Apple Podcasts or recommend it to a friend. We're opening 2022 with a book that was not banned, but is essential reading if you want to understand popular smut. I've already covered some important popular romance, like Jackie Collins' The Stud from the 70s and Kathleen Windsor's Forever Amber from the 40s. I seem to be working my way backwards in the romance canon, which is very anti-chronological of me. This episode, I'm tackling The Sheik by E.M. Hull, which was published in 1919. We would say The Sheik today, but it was pronounced Sheik at the time. When I read it, I was astonished it wasn't blacklisted, because it's properly smutty. It was published before the Censorship of Publications Act even existed, but as we know, that means nothing. Mary Stopes' non-fiction work Married Love dated from 1918, but was one of the first books banned by the Irish state. Like The Sheik, Married Love was extremely popular. If you took these two works together, you could argue they represent a shift in how women's sexual desire was publicly discussed. Obviously, a sex education work is going to be received differently to a novel, but it is still strange that Stopes was banned, but Hull was not. The Sheik is a romance thriller, told mostly from the point of view of Diana Mayo, a rich aristocrat without an idea in her head beyond sport and travel. In the opening chapter, we are told that she was raised almost as a boy by her indolent older brother, and that she is a cold fish who cannot abide men flirting with her. She is headstrong and bloody-minded, setting off alone across the desert, the only woman in a party of local men. Inevitably, this goes terribly wrong. By chapter 2, she has been abducted by the sheik of the title, Ahmed Ben Hassan. I was pretty shocked when the novel then turned into an extended racist rape fantasy. Hull's narrative wallows in the trauma Diana suffers, which is doubly horrible because the man who overpowers her is an Arab. The sex might be implicit, but it's unmistakable. Honestly, how was this not banned? It wouldn't be ridiculous to discuss The Sheik alongside The Lustful Turk, a 19th century porno I've read in a previous episode. I just had to do an episode on this novel. I knew you'd all appreciate it. I asked Dr. Ellen Turner of Lund University to join me for this one. Ellen has written extensively about The Sheik, particularly how the novel continues to ripple through culture today. Now, I did record this when I had a nasty cold, so I must apologise for my voice. It goes a bit weird sometimes. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me to discuss this crazy desert fantasy. It'll be very not a January type of book, which should lift the spirits.
I know, it's rather nice talking from a snowy Sweden. It's quite nice to be transported to the desert sands for a little while.
Well, we can pretend the weather is warm, yes, at least.
Yes, absolutely.
So first off, I usually choose a drink to go with the book. And for me, one of the standout moments was when Diana first dines with the Sheik. This is after he's kidnapped her, which is, you know, quite something. And he refuses the alcohol, saying that abstinence from booze is his only virtue. Wink, wink. Suddenly, Diana has one of these many moments. I mean, this was repeated throughout the text, where his foreignness, and specifically, I suppose, in this case, his Muslim and Arabic origins, really, they come to the fore, and she almost is physically revolted. And I felt that that was a device that she used, where she would forcibly remember his charms were only skin deep and that he was, in fact, you know, a dirty foreigner. Do you think any other drink choices capture something of the novel?
Well, I think wine certainly fits very well. The scene you describe is really interesting. Diana doesn't taste much and her mind is empty, but it's kind of notable that, like, one of the things that does penetrate her empty mind is the fact that this wine is poured for her alone. As you say, his abstinence, a marker of his supposed Arabness. I mean, it's interesting that all these references to his Arabness become even more poignant when we learn at the end of the novel that he's not actually an Arab by blood at all, son of an English lord and a Spanish lady. Anyway, sorry, back to the question. What drink would I choose to go with the book? Well, tea and coffee feature quite prominently in the novel. So setting out on her fateful expedition, Diana takes enough tea to last her the duration of her planned month-long trip. And when she's captured, this tea is served to her by the Sheik's faithful servant. When her tea runs out, this marks a month of captivity. And after this time, she's served coffee. And the Arabic coffee that she drinks for the rest of the novel is hailed as the nectar of the gods. So I think the shift from tea to coffee neatly encapsulates her leaving behind these very English habits. On the other hand, I kind of want to have a cocktail here because we're talking about the Sheik. And I think a cocktail might capture some of the Sheik fever of the 1920s. So I'm thinking something with Bombay Sapphire. Maybe the Savoy's Hanky Panky, sweet vermouth gin and a dash of Fernet Branca. Yeah, I think a bit of Hanky Panky seems apt. But I also read that there was a Rudolph Valentino inspired cocktail, Blood and Sand, which I think was inspired by a later movie from 1920s sometime anyway. And I think that's Scotch, a sweet vermouth, cherry liqueur and orange juice. Sounds pretty potent.
Does, yeah. A bit like Rudolph Valentino on the screen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, although there aren't any cocktails drunk in the novel, there is a very flapper 20s vibe throughout. So yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it seems to me what the reader would have drunk.
Yes, I would have aspired to drink. She was probably at home on a Sunday afternoon, but, you know, thinking about, yes, Friday night. And I think we should really start by explaining how popular this novel is. It inspired a wildly popular film of the same name that made Rudolph Valentino, who we already discussed, one of the biggest stars of the era. And this book was phenomenally successful, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty impossible to establish exact sales figures from the text, and it's difficult to estimate a readership. But one of the early scholars to talk about the Sheik, Billy Melman, notes that between 1919 and 1923, a phenomenal 108 editions of the novel appeared in Britain alone. And the audience figures for the 1921 film adaptation probably amounted to millions. And it was really this George Melford 1921 adaptation with Rudolph Valentino that cemented the reputation of the novel. And from anecdotal evidence, from the mere quantity of mentions in magazines, newspapers, other novels, etc., I think we can quite safely conclude that this was wildly popular. But what for me, I think, is like the biggest measure of its popularity is the influence that it had on culture on a number of different levels. It had a massive impact on fashion, music, holiday destinations, interior design. And apparently in the 1930s, there were even chic brand rubber condoms on the market.
I mean, okay.
It's interesting that the Oxford English Dictionary credits Hull's novel and the subsequent film adaptation with the secondary definition of the word chic as, and I quote, a type of strong romantic lover, a lady killer.
Wow, so the word chic comes to mean the hero in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's made its way into the Oxford English Dictionary. And the chic's counterpart was the Sheba.
Oh.
From another 1920s film. And incidentally, on the theme of chics and cocktails, I came across a satirical wanted ad in a 1920s issue of the Sunday Pictorial asking for a quote here, handsome, well-educated man, Arab not objected to, for American bar, a cocktail chica.
Oh my God. I mean, it's a really strong cultural touchstone then as a result of the book and the film combined. It just creates this cultural phenomenon.
Yeah, I think it cannot be underestimated, really. There's a huge number of imitations and parodies of the novel and the film. We've got things like Felix the Cat Shatters the Chic, a short animation film from 1926. She's a Chic, where the tables are turned and Ooh. The kidnapper is a woman. A pretty dreadful parody by Charles Somerville, The Shriek, a satirical burlesque.
I mean, it's extraordinary. I'm trying to think of a contemporary equivalent. I mean, maybe the Marvel universe on cinema is so huge now that it's, you know, superhero culture has really disseminated everywhere. Maybe that's a kind of an equivalent where you have so many tie-ins.
It is. But I guess that's a universe. And this just comes from like one novel and the film adaptation. And it's really interesting that like the afterlife of the Sheik has just kept on going up to the present day. So although the boom for Sheiks abated towards the end of the 1920s, romance publishers today, Harlequin, Mills and Boone, for instance, still do a roaring trade in these fantasies. I confess I haven't read them all. in fact, not that many of them. But they've got some fantastic titles. So a few from recent years. We've got The Sheik's Secret Baby, The Playboy Sheik, Vampire Sheik, How to Seduce the Sheik, Sheik's Ransom, Sheik's Baby of Revenge, The Sheik's Christmas Conquest, Secret Agent Sheik.
Oh no, that's good.
But my personal favourite, I think, is Pride and Prejudice and the Sheik, a sort of literary mashup. And it's a slightly weird example there. But the more I look, the more I find. They're everywhere.
Wow. So this is a really, although it's not a very famous literary text, it has profound cultural implications even today.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just remarkable because they're the sort of books that we don't think of as important, really, isn't it? You know, they don't get the credit. They don't get a review article in the big daily newspapers on their 100th anniversary or anything.
No, but they've had such a massive cultural influence. Yeah.
And at the time, it was described by some contemporaries as one of the era's sex novels. And initially, I thought that was a crazy thing to say about a book that wasn't banned in Ireland, because as you know, they ban everything. But then I read it and I would absolutely agree, because I was genuinely shocked by the role that sex played in the narrative. I'd describe it not just as a sex novel, but as you said, an extended racist rape fantasy, really. Now, it isn't explicit, but I do think it offers a masterclass in suggestion. And just to give people an idea who haven't read it, what I mean, here's a piece from chapter 3. Obedient now, she forced herself to lift her eyes to his, and the shamed blood surged slowly in her cheeks. His dark, passionate eyes burnt into her like a hot flame. His encircling arms were like bands of fire, scorching her. His touch was torture. Helpless, like a trapped wild thing, she lay against him, panting, trembling, her wide eyes fixed on him, held against her will. Fascinated, she could not turn them away, and the image of the brown, handsome face with its flashing eyes, straight, cruel mouth and strong chin seemed searing into her brain. Now, I know she says his touch is torture, but it seems quite nice. It's quite exquisitely desirable, this torture. And I felt this was really all about raw sexual attraction and the potency of lust. I mean, do you think I'm reading too much into this, or do you agree that the novel is pretty much saturated with sex?
Yeah, no, I don't think you're reading too much into this at all. It's drenched in it. And the passage that you point out, I think, really illustrates this. I don't think I can beat your pick there for sheer suggestibility. I was thinking of the frequent references to Ahmed Ben Hassan's the Sheikh's strong, skilled fingers. Hull writes about the power of these long, lean fingers that could be gentle when he chose. I thought that was pretty suggestible as well. But I mean, other interesting things that come to mind when I think about the sex in the novel is really centered around this rape fantasy and the victim blaming that goes on here as well. Mm. That Diana is just too beautiful. Somehow the rape is her fault. And this is something that persists also into 21st century popular romance novels.
I remember she felt like she didn't stop it enough, that she didn't protest enough. And there's all this awful self-flagellation afterwards. And you're like, but you've just been kidnapped. How can you possibly be blaming yourself? This is not someone you knew or met or in. I mean, you've been abducted. But yeah, there were lots of extended passages where she tortures herself for what happens to her.
Yeah, and this rape fantasy staple of the plot is really quite utterly perplexing, I find, that Diana, she's completely broken by the Sheikh. And Hull writes, and I quote here, "She could only wait and suffer in the complete moral collapse that overwhelmed her. Her body was aching with the grip of his powerful arms. Her mouth was bruised with his savage kisses." And again, a quote from the novel, "She had fought until the unequal struggle had left her exhausted and helpless in his arms, until her whole body was one agonized ache from the brutal hands that forced her to compliance, until her courageous spirit was crushed by the realization of her own powerlessness and by the strange fear that the man himself had awakened in her, which had driven her at last moaning to her knees." And I thought that was another very suggestible, this bringing her moaning to her knees. And it's interesting that Diana reminds the Sheikh of one of his thoroughbred horses. She's wild, defiant, she must be tamed. And midway through the novel, really quite abruptly, the Sheikh's goal is realised. She's fallen in love with her kidnapper and rapist. It seems to just happen on a hairpin, quite suddenly she knew that she loved him, and she'd loved him even when she hated him. That's what she said.
Of course. I mean, that's the only way it's convincing.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss.
plushcare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I found a lot of that where she fails to resist. I found that really distressing, and the way that she ends up being spiritually broken and collapses. I just thought that was really ick reading it now. But clearly that wasn't the paramount reaction of the time. It just couldn't have been.
No, I don't think so. I have the same reaction to it, and it makes me wonder how this could have sort of slipped past and become so popular.
All of this sexual content. Now, I should say that, you know, it sort of stops. It has this habit of bruised and then stops, and then the next page is a new chapter and it's the morning after. So I don't want people to get the notion that there's actual sex scenes in it. It's more like preludes and anticipations and then recalling. Did the sexual content of the novel attract condemnation at the time? Was this rape storyline at all controversial?
Yes. Contemporary reviewers did condemn the novel for its sexual content, but these reviews tended to not be very explicit, much like the novel itself. So one contemporary review states, and I quote here, "This is by no means food for babes and is also the kind of book one would not allow one's mother to read." Famously, the Literary Review called the novel poisonously salacious.
Ooh.
So weirdly, the fact that at the centre of the storyline is rape was like largely disregarded, I think, in the reviews. And weirder still, it was, and I think still is, frequently overlooked in late 20th and early 21st century commentary on the novel as well. One kind of notable instance is in the introduction to the 1996 Virago reprint of the novel, where Kate Saunders claimed that it was, and I quote her here, "pornography so soft you could give it to your grandmother." And I find that so surprising.
Yeah.
That Virago should have categorized The Sheik as a harmless erotic novel, as this kind of twee or kitsch text. So I find that quite surprising.
I think in many ways there's a lot of horror elements. You know, there's moments where you're truly appalled. And I mean, surely that must have been experienced by readers at the time. You know, there were plenty of horror tropes that they were familiar with. So it is odd that it has kind of, you know, people have just let it slide.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, I think, that the contemporary responses to the novel tended not to focus on the sex, but more saw it as indicative of a general moral and aesthetic degeneration. It sort of undermined various conservative ways of thinking. My sense is that the novel's aesthetic badness overshadowed any condemnation of the rape storyline. D.H. Lawrence, for instance, talks about it just being a sort of a cheap novel. He talks about the throb of the Sheik. And Q.D. Leavis also sort of calls this trashy, a typist daydream.
So the trash is the real problem with it. Like, the content is almost irrelevant. It's the fact that it's just cheap, disposable romantic crap is the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Storm Jameson writes that the educated mind rejects the Sheik very nearly as his stomach would reject a meal of cheap cake. So there are lots and lots of these references to its badness. And I think this is really interesting because aesthetically, I don't think the novel is like all that terrible. It's not great. But it's not terrible, not in comparison to lots of the popular romances that I've read. But there's obviously something here in The Sheik that is very provoking, besides it being this very racist rape fantasy.
Yeah, because there are a lot worse novels written at this time. It's not high literary art, but it's quite readable, actually, you know, by the standards of trashy romance novels.
I would agree with you, yeah.
And I'd like to turn, I suppose, to examine the character of Diana a bit more closely and how she's presented in the novel. When she first appears, she was the classic flapper type. She has a short haircut. She's very independent. She is, of course, rich, which helps with being independent. And this type of emancipated young woman is just one of many new women generations. So there have been earlier new women. But the flapper is the 1920s version of uppity and impatient young women who refuse to accept these traditional roles assigned by the patriarchy. And to be honest, she's precisely the sort of heroine that conservatives, especially Irish censors, would dislike. In fact, they'd hate her, really. How do you think Diana, as a new woman, is treated in the novel? Is she praised or punished for that independent spirit?
I think at the novel's outset, Diana is almost a caricature of this new woman figure. Her boyishness, both in terms of her temperament and her appearance, is frequently referred to. And it's made clear that above anything else, she values her independence. So before she meets the Sheik, she has zero interest in men. And she's physically repulsed by the idea of marriage. Hull writes in the novel, and I quote here, "The idea of marriage, even in its highest form, based on mutual consideration and mutual forbearance, was repugnant to her. She thought of it with a shiver of absolute repulsion." So in her early days in the Sheik's camp, before she realizes this undying love for him, she wears her very masculine riding clothes to give her courage. But this androgyny doesn't go very deep. The cross-dressing, though, is very interesting in respect to both the novel and also to Rudolph Valentino's portrayal as the Sheik in the Melford film adaptation, where he's this rather effeminate, lipsticked figure. At the same time, he's also ultra masculine. So that's really interesting in light of the post First World War context with this generation of wounded, damaged young men. So this kind of figure of virile masculinity, but also a rather effeminate figure.
I'm very interested in what you said earlier about how the aesthetics might reflect kind of general moral degeneration, that, you know, the critique of the Sheik at the time is not the sex, but that it's somehow revolting in wider senses. And I suppose in the 1920s in England, there's a rise in the power of purity organisations such as the National Vigilance Association. I mean, Ireland isn't the only one that's kind of going through a moment of censoriousness. It just happens to bear legislative fruition in one country and not in others. And there's a conservative politician called William Johnson Hicks, and he's driving a lot of this from within the government. And people might remember him from the Well of Loneliness episode, because he played a big part in getting that book banned. And I'm struck, I suppose, by the huge popularity of a novel like The Sheik, which is full of sex, while there's a moral backlash against apparently permissive sexual behaviour. Do you think this novel and others like it played a role in those debates about sex and censorship?
Yeah, in some ways, I think the novel functioned as a scapegoat for the kind of perceived moral ills of society. And I really like Laura Frost's account of the regard that Hull was held in by her more literary, highbrow, modernist counterparts. And Frost writes, and I quote here, that Hull was not just a bad writer and The Sheik not merely a bad novel, but a chief representative of cultural degeneracy. But to the hordes of presumably female readers, The Sheik must have been thrilling and also, as we've talked about, appalling in equal measure in light of its sexual content. It did put depictions of female sexuality in easy reach of a large number of women. And surely some of this must have seeped through into such debates on sex.
Because Diana does sort of embrace the sexual side of her nature, which initially she's set up as cold and remote and definitely not interested in men. And then, you know, she's liberated into a, you know, sexually expressive person by kidnap and rape, which obviously isn't great, but it's one way of phrasing that particular journey.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. And that's one thing that scholarship on the Sheik frequently notes, is this representation of a female sexuality that wasn't very common in literature at the time. And as you say, for Diana, the Sheik awakens in her this previously dormant sexual appetite, something that she thought was lacking in her essential nature. So the Sheik ultimately inspires in her an all-consuming, and here I quote from the novel, burning and throbbing passion. So going back to the previous question about how Diana is in part a representative of the new woman, the flapper of the time, it's kind of difficult to reconcile this particular Diana, the one that's been broken by the Sheik, with the new woman. And in some respects, she becomes almost an antithesis of this emancipated figure. And here I think the novel's actually exceptionally conservative, that Diana finds previously unimaginable happiness in this very conventional heterosexual union with her Sheik, who turns out not even to be an Arab.
Which is very important. I think it would have been deeply transgressive if he'd been left properly foreign. But I can see that it has so much in it that many audiences and many readings are possible. And that must really have been at the heart of its popularity as well. As, I mean, it's a thriller, ultimately.
Yeah, there's a lot of action going on in there, isn't there, as well? Yeah,
there is a lot of horse chasing and, violence and its suggestion. Yeah, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
To conclude, we will do censorship bingo, because although it wasn't banned, it is interesting to see, you know, just how it compares to banned books and what score it might get on the bingo card. I'm guessing it won't be very rude, because so much is skirting around. I don't have a bingo square for Throb, for example. But we begin, as usual, with breasts, because they're in so many texts. Was there a reference? I mean, I don't really remember a lot of references to her physicality apart from her clothes.
There are definitely some bare breasts mentioned. There's a bit of breast heaving mentioned.
Of course there is.
Yeah.
Great. So we can tick that one. I mean, breasts is a fairly reliable one. It appears in nearly every book. Bestiality? No, definitely not.
No, I don't think so. Not in the sexual sense of the word, anyway.
Sex work. I don't remember. Was there?
Well, we have harems and we have the Sheik's previous lovers, women who were his sexual slaves. So not quite, but...
Not quite. I was thinking that would be more the orgies one. You know, where it's debauchery. You know.
Let's put that under orgies.
Let's put it under orgies, right. Racism, well, obviously, vast quantities.
Yeah, lots of it.
Lots of it. But as you say, it turns out that he's not foreign, so it's all happy in the end. Drugs. Yes, she is drugged, isn't she? Or does she just faint away?
Oh, yes, she is, isn't she, when she's doubly kidnapped.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, great. We get some drugs in there. Politics. I don't think so. There is a lot of colonial, but not necessarily politics, no. I suppose. Right. No politics then. Swearing. No, everyone's very polite.
No, we are told that the Sheik swears and curses, but I don't think we can actually hear it.
Yeah, he's very gentlemanly throughout, in spite of being a kidnapping rapist. So no, I don't think we can tick that one. Infidelity, no, because he's not married and she's not married.
No, I don't think we can tick that one.
And crime. Well, yes, the kidnapping, the rape.
Yeah, there's lots of kidnapping.
And the next one is genitalia. No, definitely not explicit enough for that.
No.
Abortion. No.
No.
Orgies. Well, yes, I think general harem, weird debauchery sex thing.
Yeah.
Sexual assault. Well, yes, obviously.
Yes, the book's premised on it. So, yes, we have to have that one.
Extramarital pregnancy. Well, no, there was no pregnancy, miraculously.
No. Diana imagines what would have happened if she was pregnant with his child, but that doesn't happen.
Great. Can't take that. Very low score so far. Masturbation. No.
No.
No sex toys either.
No.
The next one is interesting. Feminism. I suppose you can debate that as to the sort of levels of expression granted Diana, the character.
Yeah, I think that one's very much debatable. But I think as a whole, the text is not feminist. even if Diana might have started off as a feminist figure, I think ultimately she is punished for her independence. And so ultimately this is a very conservative story, I think. So I don't think we can tick feminism there.
I don't think so. Divorce. No, nobody is divorced because nearly nobody's married anyway. And then contraception. No, definitely not.
No.
It probably would have been banned even in England if it had too much contraception in it. Menstruation. No. Blasphemy. No, actually, in spite of the fact that he's, you know, supposed to be another religion, there isn't really a lot about that aspect of the plot.
No, there's quite a lot of taking the Lord's name in vain in English and French. But yeah, not really.
Oral sex. Well, that reference to the knees, of course, does beg a question. But I think we could only file that under suggestion. Then the next one, graphic violence. Well, it's not graphic, but it, you know, there is so much implicit violence, primarily the way that Diana reflects on the aftermath. You get a real sense of violence, I think.
Yeah, it is a violent novel. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it does permeate it, even though there is no descriptions of...
Between the lines, yeah.
Yeah, very much so. Much like the sex.
Mm.
And finally, queer content.
We've got the cross-dressing element.
Yes, I think so. That's very strong at the beginning, that she's a boy in some way.
Yes. Yeah, so I think we can tick that one.
I think so, yeah. I think that's definitely worth a tick. So we have 1, 2, 7. Oh, no, 8. 8. I mean, that's really quite high.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot.
That is a lot. A lot of the books that are banned in the 20s and 30s, they're about 5.
Wow. Yeah. This is really fascinating.
So, it does contain the sort of content that they were alert to.
Yeah.
And they did ban old books, even though this is, 10 years before the Act. That's no reason not to ban it. They had no problem with banning older books. So it's just odd that it was never banned. Very strange.
Isn't it? Really peculiar.
But that was just wonderful. I really enjoyed that. It was such an interesting insight into a book that was so wildly popular and that was denigrated at the time, but contains all sorts of undercurrents that could be very disturbing.
Yes, thank you so much. Really fun.
Thank you. Well, I'm still baffled The Sheik wasn't banned. Maybe because, at its heart, it's a very conservative story. Frigid, boyish woman discovers true love in the arms of a manly man. In a review for an Irish newspaper in 1919, The Sheik was listed under thrillers. The reviewer was able to ignore the sexual violence, or at least compartmentalise it as part of an adventure story set in exotic places. But it still doesn't make sense. The blacklist is stuffed with novels where sex is barely referenced, but this rape fantasy wasn't banned. Contemporary readers did enjoy the throbbing passion and the crushed lips, but the arbiters of filth, the Irish censors, completely ignored it. I think a glaring error like this tells us how random censorship is, even when it's very strict. Censors try manfully to define indecency, but they still miss it. There's something cheering about that. It shows that chaos, the very aspect of humanity that appalled them, is part of their system too. The next episode is the very last one in season 6, when I conclude my deep dive into Edna O'Brien's The Country Girls trilogy. The final book is called Girls in Their Married Bliss, a title I adored once I read the book. It's my favourite O'Brien book so far. I think it's wonderfully rude. Till then, keep your hands clean and your minds filthy.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.